Testing. Interview with Mr. Smith, Port General Manager. Date is 13th of June. Interviewer is Dan Jongling. Okay, Mr. Smith, I've interviewed a number of port administrators this past week, and even went down and talked to the Pier 4 foreman, Mr. LeBlanc. Some of the longshore input, but mainly I've been assigned to talk with port administrators, and we've had a number of questions. Maybe we could just start off with a brief biographical sketch of your career with the port.
Well, my career with the port started in January of 1967 when I was asked to accept, if I would accept an appointment as a commissioner, replace Mr. Maury Raymond, who had been a commissioner for many years and had just previously, on the month before, been elected to the county treasurer's position here in Pierce County. I was, of course, pleased and honored. I'd spent all my life in education. I was vice president of the University of Puget Sound at the time, having worked there for some 38 years. So I've been in the community all my life and have watched the port grow and been a part of the scene, so to speak. It was therefore very pleasant to become a commissioner and have a hand in some of this growth from that day forward to the present time. Mm-hmm. I served as a commissioner for 9 years, and then when Mr. Roy Perry, my predecessor, left for a fine engineering construction opportunity, headquartered in Houston, but mostly taking place over in Kuwait in the Near East, my two fellow colleagues, Mr. Cotton and Mr. Early, asked if I would accept the position as then general manager, now entitled executive director. It doesn't mean anything different. It's the same job.
Okay.
And I was most pleased, of course, to accept the opportunity. It's been a real challenge, and nice to be a part of this project that you're involved with here to again try to point up what's happened here in our community over a long period of time and how important this is to our laboring community and to the whole citizenry.
Okay. What are some of the accomplishments of the port since you've taken over as executive director?
Let me preface these remarks by saying we're very proud of the progress that we are making and have continued to make, but I don't claim credit for it. All I claim was I was here as one of the team when it happened.
Okay.
In 1976, in January, when I became the general manager, executive director, I had a different problem to face than Mr. Perry did, who had been the general manager for the previous 11 years. He had a vast and broad background in engineering, having served in the Corps of Engineers for many years and retired from it. While my work had been largely in public relations for the university, management and administrative efforts at the top level of university.
Mm-hmm.
I had done a lot of promotional work, and I discovered that since then the work here at the port is not all that different. I was promoting and selling an educational service at the university, and here we're promoting and selling a port service and a land and industrial development service. One of the key features, of course, of our work here is maintaining a team approach, and that was what I felt I had to do more than anything else, and I believe we've developed that even to a higher degree than possibly what might have been existing before, because I've been insistent that the various factors of the total port picture, labor and management of all kinds, work together and function as a team, with each person involving his own expertise and fitting that together. Some of the specific situations which have developed since 1976 have been the development at Pierce County Terminal, both the additional berth B, which made it a much more versatile terminal of it rather than a large terminal with a single berth, which gets jammed up pretty fast. We also enjoyed, about a year later, about October of 76, the first import of automobiles. And since that time, that particular cargo handling function has been enhanced many, many times to include not only the Chrysler imports, but General Motors pickup trucks known as the Love truck, and more recently the Mazda imports both trucks and particularly passenger vehicles. Just at the last here few weeks, of course, we've had the excitement occasioned by the closure of the Columbia River, and Toyota and Honda have been running cars in here at a fast rate for a period of 2 or 3 weeks. I'm sure that they'll be going back to the river now that the dredging is has opened up the channel again. Going back then again to 1976 and coming forward, in the mid-year of 76, the Total Motion Trailer Express came to us and said they had some difficulties in Seattle, largely occasioned by labor problems. And did we have a place where we could handle their ships and their cargoes? And it just happened that we did, in a location known as Terminal 7, Berth D. Mm-hmm. And so starting in about June of 76, we got the tote business. And again, I would want to emphasize the reason we got it and the reason we have been able to hold it and enhance it in the months and years since then, it's strictly been because of the ability of our labor force here, our longshore union, to do the work that was needed in a safe, secure, and expeditious manner, so that this ship, each of their two ships, gets turned around in the minimum clock hours available for unloading and loading, because they work on, you might almost say, split-second timing in their round trips to from here to Anchorage. We're very proud of that record, but it could not have been accomplished without the able ability and the continuing attention to the detail by our Local 23 of the Longshore Union. We more, well, just of July of a year ago, were able to orient tote over across the Sitkim Waterway into a brand new development known as the Alaska Terminal, and it's right here behind our office where you and I are sitting now. Modern and up-to-date in every way, it's specifically designed to handle the roll-on, roll-off ships of the tote business. That enables us now to have a terminal 7 berth D back again, and enhanced further with the addition of another large container crane, and you're looking right across the waterway behind us here at 7 D. It has a log ship online now, but that whole berth over there, that another crane right in here, is configured for a large container terminal. So that is now available to us as a result of completing the tote new Alaska Terminal. So that's another one of the projects. A big entrance gate has been added, a lot more backup land paved, because as you know, it takes a minimum of 15 acres for every container berth to handle the surge area for the containers. Mm-hmm. We've done numbers of other things in rehabilitation of older berths, 7A and B, for instance. We are working on the partial filling of slip 2, and right before us now, in fact right behind you on the table, there is an outline of our proposal for modernizing our fishboat haven in slip 2 with new floats, new utilities, and a new service dock, and that will enable us to give some expansion to Terminal 4, and we intend also to increase the length of the pier of Terminal 4 by approximately 300 feet. We have acquired, since 1976, the land behind us here, which is the rest of the Milwaukee property on the waterfront, known as parcels 2 through 7. And we have made that purchase and are now in the planning stages of how that priceless deep water related land can be properly developed for the best interests of the port and all of its stockholders, who are the taxpayers of Pierce County. That will take place in the future, but we're already doing some engineering studies on it, so it's underway. We've been buying additional straddle carriers, about at least six in the last 18 months. And these cost about $300,000 a piece, so it's a major purchase. We have, as I indicated, purchased another container crane. That's $2.5 million, so these are major additions. A new locomotive engine just arrived here this last month and will go online as soon as the shakedown is finished to handle the port's switching efforts between the docks and the Beltline Exchange Yard. We have a number of other projects in mind, both in the backland and the Industrial Development District, where we will be adding to our warehousing to handle transit cargo storage and distributive cargoes as well, that will be coming in from overseas, and our exports, of course, which we do a lot of as well. I think I may have left out some things that have taken place, but most of the additional changes will be what we're doing and planning for the future at the present time. So we're not stopping, we're moving right ahead. And all of this is done with revenue bond funds and cash flow, and it is not a cost factor back to the taxpayer, which I think is important. Of course, all of these advancements that we're planning now and the ones that have taken place mean an ever greater role to play by the labor force, the longshoremen, the teamsters, and the various artisans. We have many mechanics, machinists, carpenters, painters, etc., that are working in our maintenance department as well.
So one of the first things you mentioned, and perhaps one of the things you're most proud of, is the continuing and perhaps even increasing relationship with the Longshore Union as a whole.
Yes, that certainly is one of the items that we feel it's just absolute essential. It's like the well-being of a body. If one of its main organs isn't functioning properly, you're sick. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important. I forgot, in another project is known as the Domtar project. That the Domtar company, which is Dominion Tar and Chemical of Canada, formerly owned by Kaiser years ago, they are going to be bringing in gypsum rock here shortly, and they are now planning their structure on the Blair Waterway in a terminal facility. They'll be bringing in vast quantities of this rock from Mexico. They'll be building a manufacturing plant here and making gypsum board, wall board. That will be distributed all throughout the Northwest and wherever their marketing area is, and of course that will mean additional labor force and payroll.
Right.
I should mention too that our Fredrickson land out south of us here, 15 miles south, we have an area approximately 500 acres originally. It's now down to about 400 because of land sales. We have recently added two woodworking organizations, Industrial Lumber, a couple years ago, and just a year ago, the addition of International Forest Products, which is a subsidiary of a German firm in West Germany, in Munster, known as Ostermann and Scheibe. And they are now in operation, and they make fancy, they call it panel board, we would call it just paneling. Mm-hmm. Not plywood, but nice paneling for finishing rooms. Mm-hmm. And they will be marketing part of that in the domestic market, and part of it will be sent back to Europe. Their payroll and their labor force is already online. Another one, which has bought land from us and will be building their property or their facility soon, is known as AMA, Australia, Malaysia, American. And they too are a lumber product manufacturing. They will be buying logs and large pieces of lumber here in the domestic scene, making it into moldings and special configurations for construction. Most, or if not all, of their manufactured product will be sent back to Australia, so this provides the port with another export. Also out there, the Puget Sound Power and Light is going to put in an emergency power plant. They're getting their permits completed for that now. This will add some labor force, but it will also protect all of labor and management, as well as the people in the area, on emergency power problems. High Life Helicopter, a helicopter service organization, has recently purchased land and is going to be running their helicopter service there. This is not a taxi service so much as it is the maintenance and leasing of helicopters to people who need them. This is another area which is largely industrial. Just happens that both International Forest Products and AMA require imports and do some export.
Mm-hmm. And they will do that through the Port of Tacoma?
That's correct. Well, we certainly hope so.
Okay. This High Life Helicopters, that doesn't mean they'll be flying in helicopters, does it?
Yes, but not. This is not a helicopter service as if that was a helicopter pad for regularly scheduled service to places. They lease helicopters to other organizations on a time basis that need them, or they provide service like you might want a helicopter service from Tri-Cities to Walla Walla for a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. Just take something like that. And they would provide that service, and then they would bring the helicopters back and maintain them. In most instances, unless the location that needed the service was close by, the helicopter wouldn't be flown out. It would be loaded aboard a truck and trucked to the location that was needed. So it's like you might say a car rental area.
And they'll be storing them here on the port land?
At Frederickson.
Okay.
That's 15 miles south of where you're sitting.
That's almost in the Fort Lewis territory then, isn't it?
It's 3 miles east of Spanaway. So okay. It would basically be east of the Fort Lewis portions that you know and it's also, in a sense, north of Fort Lewis, because as you know, the Fort Lewis Reservation runs up toward the mountain behind the mountain road.
I think it's all over.
Yes.
That's quite a lot of development yet to come then for the port.
I think so. We are very fortunate. The Port of Tacoma, one of the very key factors here as we look forward to the years ahead for labor force and payroll, jobs, employment, which is one of our main cornerstones of efforts and goals. We're very fortunate, as I said, to have waterfront left yet and considerable amount of backland down here. On the so-called tide flats, we still have approximately 800 acres, not all in one piece, in different pieces. They're still available for development, and we're trying to reserve those acres for maritime-oriented development. In other words, businesses, industries, shipping areas, or whatever, that require maritime services, so that the port, as a ocean-going port, can continue to develop so that the longshore have a future to look forward to in expansion as well as other labor unions and laboring types. Keep in mind that when the tide flat area was developed and the Hylabus and the Blair waterways dredged to form that backland, at least 3,500 acres were formed out of the dredge spoil and subsequent fill from other sources. And those 3,500 acres have mostly been sold in years past to businesses and industries that are here in the area. Mm-hmm. And this, from a mud flat, has become a major industrial scene and large payroll and tax base for Tacoma and Pierce County. We do feel at this point, however, that Tacoma being a gateway port, and I want to explain just a bit about that because it'd be important in your book, I think, the concept and philosophy behind it. We do feel that these remaining acres, though they seem large to some people, are all too small for the years ahead and the demands that will be made upon us. But we do want to maintain these acres oriented toward maritime services. Now let me mention this gateway port. Let me say what it means. We compare a gateway port with a marketplace port. A couple of good examples would be Long Beach, Los Angeles. The two ports there, which are contiguous with one another, are a major marketplace port. 85% of the cargoes that come into Los Angeles, Long Beach, stay right there and are sold and used right in the greater Los Angeles area because of the tremendous population there. The ships, in essence, have to come in there. They have no alternative because that's where the products, the cargoes, are going to be used. Here in Tacoma or Seattle, 85% of what comes in here goes on through to the Midwest and East, the mountain states. And therefore, the ship doesn't really have to come here. The ship can come to any number of ports. But will come here based upon good labor production, efficiency of labor and efficiency of management, good facilities, deep water, good transportation, all those sort of things. But key to it all is top labor production. If you don't get that, the ship doesn't have to come here.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we have been increasingly successful and for the last 4 years have broken all the port records each year has to mean that we have been getting outstanding results from our labor force, and I guess we'd have to brag a little bit and say our management hasn't done so bad either.
Yeah.
But this is so important. Now, to the extent that we can have captive cargoes here and that make use of these other 800 acres or some that are already here, to that extent, then we protect the port and everyone involved with it in that the ships do have some reason for coming here other than just because we're doing a better job.
Captive cargo, what's that?
Well, for instance, look across here at the aluminum domes.
Uh-huh.
That's alumina that's coming in from Australia.
Right.
The ship can't dump it off any place but right here.
Oh, yeah.
Or this is Kaiser.
Right.
And Kaiser can't bring their alumina in anywhere but here. So the ship has to come here. But we've got a lot of rubber coming in here. We're one of the three largest rubber importing ports in America, usually one or two now. This rubber comes in from Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia. But it doesn't have to come here because it's not going to stay here. It's going to go right on through to Akron, to the rubber centers of America where the tires and other rubber products are manufactured. So we've got to do a better job. So that's not a captive cargo. Now logs out of here going to Japan, that's a captive cargo to the extent that we have a share of the logs, and then of course Olympia, Graves Harbor, Port Angeles have others, Longview. So the cargoes that are generated here or that have some unusual facility that requires them to come here to be used are what we mean by captive cargoes.
Okay.
The flow-through types can go in anywhere because they can meet the railroad train in San Francisco or Oakland or Richmond or Los Angeles or New Orleans just as easy as they can here in Tacoma and Seattle. The advantage we have with the Pacific Rim is that the ports of Tacoma and Seattle, which are the two major diverse ports on Puget Sound, are 1.5 to 3 days closer to all the areas in the Pacific Rim than any other ports in America. So that's kind of important to us.
Right. What is the outlook of the port toward the... We've been in the past primarily an operations port, and now it seems like we're turning more and more toward a landlord port as far as land development and management.
I know very clearly what you're saying. I can't quite agree that we have moved that much in the direction of a landlord port. There's nothing right nor wrong about either kind. Seattle basically is a landlord port. We're basically an operating port. But with Tote, for instance, we're a landlord port because we lease the terminal facility, Alaska Terminal, to Tote, and they operate the terminal themselves.
Mm-hmm.
On our other terminals, this is not the case. Seattle, on the other hand, leases most of their terminals. On the other hand, they have one or two which they operate. So I can't really answer your question. I don't think that it will affect labor one way or the other, because the same amount of labor is going to be required regardless of whether the port is the operator or some lessee is the operator. I think it will be based upon the specific needs of the shipper, the shipping line. Some major shipping lines may want to serve as their own landlord. Others would prefer not to take on that much of the responsibility and to have us perform the services for them. It will not adversely affect the port if we go in one way or the other. We're prepared to handle either kind.
So we are still primarily an operator?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I would think for the foreseeable future we would continue to be.
The port, of course, is not a profit organization. We do have tax support, but is it considered by its administrators to be a profit organization? I mean, do you attempt to try and make profit?
I appreciate you asking me that question because it's a very important one. Yes, your answer is we have to make a profit. At least we have to make a lot of revenue to break even. And you never want to just break even. You like to produce a little more revenue than your expenses are involved so that you can look forward to doing things in the future. Our tax base provided, I think, last year about $2.7 million. I'm speaking of 1979 as being the last complete year.
Yeah.
$2.7 million, but our total budget was around $51 million. Including capital developments, and our total operating budget was, I think, well, I can get the exact figure for you, and I will when we finish with the interview if you'd like, but I think around $25 million. In other words, our tax base was one-tenth of the operating budget, one-fifth of the total budget. So if you take away the $2.7 million, we still had to make $25 million or $24 million in order to do what we've done, in order to pay all the labor force, to buy all the equipment to maintain the port, and to proceed onward. We get, for capital development, revenue bonding. And we've spent, I suppose, in revenue bonding in the past 15 years about $60 million in addition to cash flow that we've poured into capital developments. All of our tax base of the $2.7 million, though we are allowed to use it for operations, is used for capital developments. It's poured right back into the port in terms of projects and purchases that will again produce more jobs. So we really, though we are a government body under state law, we do have this minor tax base. We still have to operate just like a private business, differing from other organizations or governments like the city, which gets a tax base and then proceeds to expend that tax base for services and facilities that are needed to operate the city. We have to furnish most of that money ourselves, you see, by behaving just like a business.
Okay. So as a operator port, as a landlord port, would the port try and make as much money as possible from the tenants in the form of rent? Is rent?
Yes, you see, your rent or your lease rental charge to a lessee who will say is renting a terminal from you, and the facilities are on the terminal: the pier, cranes, battle carriers, forklifts, if they need it, whatever they are renting from us, as well as the land and the make-ready of that land, we would have to get in the leasehold rental the same amount or greater that we would make if we actually operated it ourselves.
Okay.
You know, as an operator, we have certain tariffs and rates that we are bound by in accordance with what we publish and what is approved by the Federal Maritime Commission. A lessee would do his own thing there, and he'd pay us a gross amount. Then keep in mind that though he's leasing from the port and we're a government body and tax exempt, he has to pay, in addition to his lease, let's say his lease is $1 million a year, he has to pay 12% of that, or $120,000, in addition, in leasehold tax, in lieu of property tax. So the citizen and the government is protected, the court is protected. It's simply two different ways of doing business. One, operating yourself, the facilities, and performing services. The other is leasing it. We'll say, I lease it to you, and you perform those same purposes, services for yourself.
Okay. So we do not give away our land under the landlord system at all?
Absolutely not. Again, in leasing it, you are maintaining the ownership of it in perpetuity for the stockholders of Pierce, of Port of Tacoma, who are the taxpayers of Pierce County. So we like the lease leasehold tax arrangement and the lease approach, but operating we're used to, and we're not backing away from that.
Of course, as an operator, we keep the land as well.
Sure. Either way.
So how many instances do we actually sell the land? Have we sold any?
We don't sell the land down here in the Tide Flat area anymore at all. That's our policy. Now, that's an unwritten policy. There is no law that precludes us from selling land down here. We simply say that the best interest of the taxpayers, our stockholders, is to maintain ownership in perpetuity. We do not feel that this makes it difficult for a new company to come in and do business with us. If the company is properly and reasonably financed, our bankers that we've talked to and financiers say that there's no difference between the lease or the ownership. There is maybe in the desire of an owner to acquire the enhancement of the inflationary value or the enhancement of the land costs and to realize that as an investment, but we feel that that belongs to the taxpayers of Pierce County.
Okay. And approximately when would you say that that unwritten law came to being? Has that been for a long time?
No, it came into being when the leasehold tax law was passed in 1976, which happened to be coincidental almost with my arrival here as the executive director.
Mm-hmm.
So we gave some thought and consideration to this, and along about, I think, toward the end of that year, arrived at that conclusion. When prior to that time, for the port to use all this land and just let it lie there, lie fallow, was not a valid situation or proper either. The only way you could get it back on the tax rolls, keep in mind that one of our purposes, besides providing jobs, was to develop a tax base.
Okay.
And so that the people are protected who live here, and this isn't just a bedroom area, it's an area with industry and business that produces a big tax base. So this is what we have done, and up until the time the leasehold tax came into a picture, we had to sell the land to get it back on the tax roll.
Yeah.
Now we don't.
So the leasehold law in 76 was quite a development.
It certainly was.
The ports in the state. State law.
It was state law, and it brought about a complete change of philosophy and approach to things. It doesn't mean you can't sell land,
right?
But
why shouldn't we bother?
Yeah, why should? And it hasn't slowed up development here any that I'm aware of at all.
Okay. The Port of Tacoma's diversity seems to be a major plus for its attraction of businesses. Does just as a comparison to Seattle, are they much less diverse than we are? Are they overly containerized, would you say, or not really?
I don't think I'd use the adjective or the adverb overly in describing their container results. They have done an outstanding job there to become one of the great container ports of America.
Mm-hmm.
We have our foot in the container world, and it will grow as the years go by. However, being as close as we were, you might say two jumps, a spit in a hound's bay from our friends in Seattle, we had to say, what was our role? And since we did have land and waterfront available and deep water and transportation, that sort of thing, we felt that our role was to become and remain a diverse handling port so that we were not hung up by a particular industry. For instance, forest products has long been a key, you might say, to the economy of the whole Western Washington area. Mm-hmm. But as you know, forest products, timber, lumber, and that sort of thing, logging, it goes up and down. And as a result of that, of the ups and downs in the industry from time to time, we would suffer the same way. But logs and lumber and forest products are a key factor at the Port of Tacoma, but just one of the factors. And what adversely affects that world like today with construction down has not made a dent in the port's revenues or income or jobs as far as we're able to detect within the port itself. We therefore have felt that our destiny and our best interest over the long haul was to be able to do a lot of things, to keep on handling break bulk. A lot of ships are still break bulk ships. They don't containerize, or they only partially containerize. And so when the ship comes in here, he has containers on berth, on deck, or maybe in a couple of the cells, break bulk in a couple of others, and he wants to get tallow in his four peak tanks, we can handle the whole thing at one terminal. Again, this protects labor and jobs. Break bulk, for instance, is a type of cargo handling that produces, I think, more jobs on the waterfront than does containers. On the other hand, containers are very efficient, safe for the cargoes that they handle, and it's the coming way in the world, there's no doubt about it. So we're just moving gradually and staying with the industry, and I think we supplement Seattle rather than just compete with them.
Probably couldn't compete at this point outright anyway.
Well, yes and no. On some things we obviously can because they can't touch us at all. They're not handling aluminum, they're not handling alumina, they're not handling logs and lumber.
They're not at all?
No. On the other hand, they do handle some steel, and we only handle it intermittently as the demands are made. But special things came along, like the movement to Prudhoe Bay, of all those big modules were built and barged up there. We had the backland to do it, the barge terminal, the area to handle it all, and so we did that. We're able still to meet new things, new changes in the industry. For instance, right now, let's talk for just a moment about containers, because you mentioned them and your interest in them. There are two types of ways of handling containers. One of them is a typical container yard, which the containers are picked up by straddle carriers or transtainers, moved to the edge of the vessel, the special container cranes that you see behind us here, pick them up off the straddle carrier off the ground, lift them aboard ship, and vice versa. It's handled the same way, and they're stacked in a yard. They can be stacked two or three high, just like a bunch of children's blocks. Mm-hmm. That's an efficient way of handling cargo, but the modern way that it's moving toward is known as the chassis method. Now, what does that mean? It simply means that when the container comes off a vessel with the crane lowers it onto a chassis, a flatbed, if you will, a flatbed trailer. Mm-hmm. A hustler, which is nothing more nor less than the front end of a truck and trailer, grabs a hold of it and moves it into the yard for storage, or moves it directly alongside of a rail car for transfer to the rail, or piggybacks it right up on top of the car.
So it saves even one more step.
Now, the difference being, you can stack containers at least two high, and three high if you want to in a yard. Mm-hmm. You can't stack chassis with containers on them. Therefore, remember I told you it takes about 15 acres of backland alongside of a single container pier to handle that container ship or the shipping on that container berth. For a chassis yard, it takes 30.
Right.
So very few ports in America today that will be able to move into the chassis handling area of the container world without major and tremendously expensive and costly efforts on their part in terms of dollars. So we're patient. Mm-hmm. We think that the future of the Port of Tacoma isn't going to stop.
Okay. We have the room to expand in that direction.
That's correct.
Is there much of an industrial trend toward that expansion at this point? Toward that?
There is a very noticeable trend toward it. It's known in the in the industry as mini bridge, or once in a while you'll hear it spoken of as micro bridge. Simply means that the vessels come in from the Pacific Rim, we'll say, and they come to the port, to a port. The container's taken off and put immediately upon a train, or soon after or thereafter as is possible, instantaneously if it were possible. These will become, and are already in some instances, known as unit trains. There are 50 cars, or maybe 75. They're nothing but containers. That's all they are. Mm-hmm. And this train comes in, and parked there on the tracks alongside of the pier or wherever close by, those containers are put on there and they are rushed back to their destiny in the Midwest or the East. And that train comes back carrying a load of empties or carrying a load of containers with export cargoes. And that's occasioned partially by the ever-increasing costs of operation, both in labor and facilities. Ships now, $50 million is just about what you expect to spend to build a new ship, a container ship, certainly. The changes that have been brought about recently in the Panama Canal are a major force in this direction. Both the fact that the canal can only handle ships up to a certain size, the fact, of course, that the government has now relinquished the ownership of the canal, and greater amounts of control of that will be under the Panamanian government. Cost factors are going up in the canal, and so the traditional ship flow that went through the canal into the Gulf ports or to the East Coast may very well come in here, enjoy the 1.5 to 3 day quicker time frame into getting into ports of Seattle and Tacoma, for instance. We must then make, working with the railroads, make a quick exchange and have those trains going on into the Midwest and East, and they'll save several days over the time-honored route through the canal and into the Gulf and trains from there or up the barge rivers up the canals and Mississippi or around to the East Coast. That's becoming then a major movement.
So we may go back to the days almost before the canal when everything had to go over by land.
That's correct.
Increase the land transportation.
Absolutely.
Due only in part to the recent canal treaties.
Yes.
And due in part to the bigger ships. The canal can't.
The bigger ships. I think the bigger ships, however, have not been affected by the canal as far as containers so far, though they're getting some bigger ones. Mm-hmm. But the big bulkers have, and that's right. Been a factor. Of course, that doesn't go mini bridge. The other, sort of mini bridge in reverse is the handling of grain. The grain that used to go through the canal, particularly the corn and feed grains, has all of a sudden, because of the rail rates being even, so that we were competitive with the Gulf, all that grain is flowing through here now, and our grain handling out of the port of Tacoma from Continental and United Grain, our two big elevators, has more than doubled in the last year. They're on double shifts now, again, twice as many people here in the port of Tacoma switching as there were a year and a half ago. Something like 4,300,000 tons of grain went out of here last year. Twice as much, incidentally, a little over twice as much as Seattle. So we have some advantages.
Mm-hmm. And grain is now even more of a weight product, has more weight than lumber exports, does it not? Or does that, are they still pretty much?
No, I don't think you can properly compare them. Now here again, we're landlords for both United Grain and for Continental. We own the land, we own the facility, but they lease it from us. Mm-hmm. In the United Grain situation, we do handle their switching, but whereas Continental handles their own over there by Stadium High School. But I don't think that it's appropriate to compare them. They're both crops.
Right.
The logs, people get excited about, a lot of people don't understand and feel that we're robbing ourselves of a one-time resource. It just takes longer to grow trees than it does wheat, that's all important. Mm-hmm. But it's the same essence. You have to work within your sustained yield and your ability to produce. They're both very helpful, but in one case, we only lease, and the logs, we handle our logs here.
Okay. Would you say, we haven't talked about the mechanization agreement yet. I just came from Mr. Jones and trying to get things straight. Would you say you started in 67?
70, yes, 67.
As a commissioner. Mm-hmm. Would you say that the mechanization agreement has been a big factor in Tacoma's history since it was signed, or not really?
I think it has probably a significant impact here, but we've been able, I believe, to overcome the impact that would have had a negative result on the labor force. We said to the labor, the longshore leadership here, that as far as we were concerned, that we would dedicate ourselves to something like this, that if they could see fit to go along with automation and mechanization, if you want to call it that, that we would try to guarantee them more work than they've ever had before. And so far we've been able to do that. I don't think it's like fighting the incoming tide. You can do so just to certain, you know, you can build some sand dikes and so forth and so on. Pretty soon you're overcome.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a question of moving with the modernization and the handling of cargoes, and recognizing that people and jobs need to be protected. But you just can't handle it like a welfare situation. Now, interestingly enough, here in Tacoma, to the best of my knowledge, this business about being put out of work because of mechanization, this type of thing, has never taken place here, and they've yet to use $1 of that fund that was established at that time.
For Tacoma.
Interesting.
That's a good point.
You ought to check that, but that's my understanding, that they have yet to do it. And of course, we being management of the port, and they, the leadership of the local, are both proud of this, being able to produce, keep people working. I guess some people might like to get some money for doing nothing, and it might have to if there wasn't a job, you know. In other words, they'd have to be protected to some extent. But I think you're happier over the long haul if you're doing something productively and have a hand in seeing something grow and produce and continue.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our goal.
Are there any changes that you would, as the executive director, like to make from the port's previous philosophies? Or did you kind of rather step right in and say, yes, these are good and I'd like to continue these? Did you make any changes, or would you like to see any changes made?
Well, since I kind of had a hand in the some of these changes that have taken place, I guess to protect myself, I'd have to say I'm satisfied the way it is. But that's perhaps partially facetious. I think we have to stay on our toes and accept the fact that change is the order of the transportation business and the transportation world, and that's what we are a part of.
Mm-hmm.
What the intermodal changes that are bringing about now, which Mini Bridge is partially part of, these changes are going to necessarily bring problems. They'll bring problems of rating structure, problems of cargoes being shunted from here to there, perhaps. Problems that maybe involve the labor force. We have to be smart enough to solve those and establish policies that meet these moving changes. And to say that here is the law of the Medes and the Persians, so to speak, and if we follow these dictums, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, from now till hell freezes, everything is going to be fine. It isn't.
Right.
So change is the order of the day, and we've got to be prepared to.
Did you make any comment on the career of Roy Perry before you took over his position? Did you say it was exceptional?
Roy came at an unusual time in the history of the port, and I want to take my hat off to the commissioners who at that time had made a decision a little bit earlier to dredge these two waterways and to establish all this backland.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw that this was a time when they had to move ahead with development. They just couldn't leave all of this land down here like a vast open prairie for nothing. It was designed and zoned for a port and for heavy industry and businesses and so on. And so they looked around, and in their wisdom, they chose Mr. Perry, who was a fairly young man at the time. I think he was about 45 or 46 and retiring as a colonel from the Corps of Engineers, and was at that time the resident engineer or district engineer for this district for the Corps. So he knew the port pretty thoroughly and had participated in some of the developments relative to the dredging and filling and all the areas around here. He's a very energetic man, obviously a very smart person, a very capable engineer. And he came in here and I think just did an outstanding job. And from about 65, I believe he came, until 76 in January when he left. It was my privilege to be a part of the time when Roy was here for all but just the first year and a half. I think he came in July of 65, and I joined him then in January of 67.
Right.
So I watched his development through the years and what he's been able to do. He did some outstanding construction work over in Kuwait, and after about 2 years, felt that was enough. He'd had a challenge there, and he came back to the United States. And right at that point of time, we were making a change in our New York representatives. See, we have an office in New York, one in Chicago, one in Tokyo, and one in Singapore.
The port does?
Yes.
Oh.
So they're searching for cargoes and shippers and that sort of thing, and developing new clients and shipping lines. And we had a new man coming into New York, and we felt that it was enough for him to get used to all the busy business there without expecting him to do anything for us in Washington. I'd been going back, as Roy had when he was here, to discuss with the MARAD, with the Corps of Engineers, with federal bureaus of other kinds, with the congressional delegation, matters of concern and consideration to the port, whether it was federal legislation or rules, regulations, or whatever. And we needed someone to do that on a little bit more of an ongoing basis, at least for a while, because there were a number of things that were involved. And Roy was available, and I asked him if he'd come back in our employ for a while at least to help us through a very busy period while we were getting this new man oriented in the New York area, and he'd handle some of the Eastern Seaboard business appointments for us, as well as being our man in Washington, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
He agreed to do that, and then thereafter worked with us for another 14 months, and then last August, there having been come a vacancy in the Port of Los Angeles in the top job. We talked to him about it and suggested, hey, we'd love to have you stay with us, but how about this, because would be the real challenge. Make a long story short, he did apply and eventually was accorded the position and is now the executive director of the Port of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you'd have to say that he's been outstandingly successful in the port business, and I think the funny joke about it, as he went down there, some of the folks up here said, what did you let him go and do that for? He's down there in the enemy's camp, he'll take all the secrets of the Port of Tacoma there. And I said, well, you could look at it that way. I tended to look at it more from the standpoint that we now had infiltrated the Port of Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard comments to the effect that, there we lost Roy Perry, but you said we actually recommended him to apply for the job.
Sure we did. Yeah. Told him about it. That's right. And you have to have the attitude, I think, that there are opportunities for people to come along, and they aren't all within the very maybe confined area of the organization, the industry, or the particular business with whom he might be associated at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
I felt this way when I was up at the university, and I do now, that we're not that big an organization that we can expect everybody to stay here in perpetuity and hope that maybe somebody will get out of the way somewhere, or the retirements will take place, or deaths fast enough so that people can move in.
Yeah.
The fact you have to take pride in the fact when dealing with your laboring force at whatever level they are and whatever responsibility, that you've been capable as an industry or a business in bringing this individual along to a point where he or she's in demand by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Yeah. And as you said, we might have special connections with the L.A. Fourth.
Well, we do. We have a very friendly relation. Before that, the man who had been the executive director of the Port of Los Angeles was a very fine person by the name of Fred Crawford, but unfortunately he came from the Port of Seattle.
No. Okay, I think that's about it for today, Mr.
Very good.
Certainly like to thank
nice
you
to
for
talk
your
with you. Betcha. Pleasure. As you can no doubt see, I'm pretty full of the Port of Tacoma.
Right.
Yeah, here's some volcanic ash.
Oh yeah, sure enough. Yeah, a friend of mine, he gave us a little package of that too.
Yeah.
Might be getting some off our cars here any day.
Well, it's...
Stop.